Welcome to episode 4 of the Not Your Mama's Autism podcast. I'm Lola Dada Ollie. In episode 3, my husband, Tosan, and I described certain events that spurred the paradigm shift from autism sibling to autism parent. In episode 4, we present to you the origin story of our baby girl, the family firebrand, and warrior princess of authenticity, Alero. No two pregnancies, just like no two people, are truly the same. While my first pregnancy involved a child that enjoyed kickboxing me in the womb, baby girl was more of a gentle soul with not nearly as much movement. My original plan was to have kids spaced out between 3 and 4 years apart, like my parents had. That way, when one was entering college, the other one would be on his or her way out. But alas, that would not end up being the case for us. With an 18-month-old at home, and less than 6 months into my promotion to a new job, I wasn't feeling too hot one day. It was the same kind of not feeling too hot feeling that I felt with my son. So I went across the street to the drugstore and grabbed a pregnancy test. That would give me 2 kids under the age of 3 in the house. Interesting. I bought the test and walked back across the street to work. Unlike the first go-round, I was not as patient when it came to waiting to find out. Since I was already well aware as to how life-changing having a child was, if I was indeed pregnant in a still brand new job, I needed to start really planning. So I took the test in the work bathroom and found out right then and there. A good old plus sign showed itself again. I smiled. I just lost 25 pounds from the first pregnancy and was only 5 pounds away from my goal. First on my to-do list on the road to baby number 2 would be to cancel my Weight Watchers subscription. Okay, what's next? Ah, yes. Call Tosa. Since he was actually awake this time, he showed an appropriate response of happiness immediately without me having to coerce him out of sleep. After I hung up with him, I started contemplating how and when I should break this news to a boss in a job I had been in less than 6 months. Since my first pregnancy was not exactly a walk in the park, I knew that I may have to tell my boss sooner rather than later so that we can be on the same page. For now, I would bask in the newness of this. Shortly after discovering I was pregnant again, I knew that this road to babydom would be slightly different. I couldn't keep much food or liquid down and actually lost weight instead of gaining it for 2 weeks in a row. Amazing silver lining, though, was that Tosa and I found out that we would be parents to a baby girl.
I was excited, you know. I tried to bluff as much as possible that no, you know, she would not have me wrapped around her fingers, but she probably did right from the ultrasound.
As my pregnancy progressed, I became borderline hypertensive, now putting me in danger of preeclampsia, a serious medical condition that can cause pregnancy complications for both mom and baby. It didn't help matters that I would be commuting over an hour door to door from home to work while pregnant. The stress of that commute, along with the difficult pregnancy, caused my doctor to put me on bed rest in my last trimester. It would be while on bed rest that I would hear news that no mother would want to hear. During a routine prenatal visit, the nurse practitioner was performing an ultrasound. The look on her face made me realize that something was not quite right. Lola, we can't hear a heartbeat right now. So we will keep you here under observation for a bit until we can hear one. Okay, I thought, I've got to stay calm. I sat in observation for hours. I was mentally preparing myself to give birth earlier than expected. A couple of hours went by when a heartbeat could finally be heard. The medical team thought that it was okay for me to go back home. It was at least 8 weeks or so prior to my due date, so the goal was not to induce me anytime soon if they didn't have to. I did my best to reduce stress while still working and having a toddler around the house. My friends decided to throw a baby shower for me in February so that it would be both a birthday and a baby shower dual theme for me. Truly felt appreciative that so many girlfriends would choose to come together for me. Despite being in the last stretch of a difficult pregnancy, as I reflect on that moment today, that was probably the last time I would feel some sense of normalcy for a very long time. What I particularly remember was that I was in familiar territory. I was in a close friend's home surrounded by amazing people. There was a lot of laughter. I was showered in love and friendship. Corny baby shower games were played. Rich food was eaten. What I didn't know was that baby girl was planning on making her world debut approximately 3 weeks early. As I was prepping to get to bed on the night of my baby shower / birthday party, contractions started. Baby girl decided to ignore our original plans to have a scheduled C-section 3 weeks out. She was coming that night. Contractions hit hard. I told Tosan that it was time to get to the hospital. Perhaps it took him longer to process that baby girl destroyed our original labor plans, but this man actually asked me if I was really having contractions. Yes, I was sure, husband. Yes, I was sure. My bag for the hospital was packed and ready. After getting dressed, Tosan grabbed the bag and we started making our way down the stairs and out of the house. We told mom and dad, Tosan's parents, who were around to help us for a time such as this, that the time had come. We got in the car, and Tosan takes this as an opportunity to drive under the speed limit. As a woman now dealing with stronger and more frequent contractions at what felt like a dizzying pace, I briefly contemplated punching him in the face. But I digress. Please speed up. I'm having a baby here, I recall telling my life partner. He bumped it up about 5 more miles an hour. Why was this man doing this to me? I thought. Because of my track record of difficult pregnancies, we didn't want to change my OBGYN. The team knew my medical history, but that meant that this trip to the hospital would now be an hour long from suburbia into the city. With contractions remaining unforgiving, this trip felt like 3 hours. We eventually got to the hospital. We told the team who our doctor was, and I went through intake. We were directed to an area to wait. I waited for several minutes. The contractions were getting more painful, and I noticed that the nurse available seemed to be reading notes and writing some things down, but not really paying attention to me at all. Excuse me. Are we prepping for my C-section? I finally asked in between contractions and what I thought at least was obvious pain to anybody paying attention. Oh, you're getting a C-section? She asked. I'm glad you said something. You were almost at the point where that would have no longer been possible, she said. I was floored. What was she talking about? I thought. I went through intake. I was literally sitting in a hospital where my medical records were. I was a high enough risk pregnancy to warrant a pre-scheduled C-section. All this time had passed, and she hadn't checked my file? Why wouldn't she check my file? What was happening? Why was this happening? It would be questions I would later ask myself for years. Likely due to the sudden nature of this C-section that I would now need 3 weeks early, my typical OBGYN was not available. Now sedated, I couldn't feel much from the waist down, and it was customary to block the lower half of my body from view. Tosan sat right before that midpoint initially, holding my hand. Baby girl would be here any moment. I was no longer in pain, but I did feel them take baby girl out of my body. All 9 pounds, 4 ounces of her. But I didn't hear any type of crying at all. Tosan, typically stoic in high-stress situations, couldn't hide the concern on his face. I knew something was wrong. I overheard the doctor speaking with his team. That's interesting, he said. She's not that old. Still, no crying. Tosan looked at me, looked back at baby girl. I told him that it was okay to be with her, that I would be fine. I went in and out of consciousness from that point. I would later find out that baby girl was not breathing and swallowed meconium. According to the Johns Hopkins Medicine website, meconium is the first feces or stool of a newborn. A baby swallowing meconium results in breathing problems, so doctors and nurses suction it out of the lungs as soon as possible. That's what they had to do with baby girl. Her initial Apgar score was low. According to Healthline.com, an Apgar score is a scoring system doctors and nurses use to assess newborns between 1 and 5 minutes after they're born. 10 is the highest score one can receive, and it's based on 5 criteria: heart rate, breathing, muscle tone, reflex irritability, and skin color. Typical Apgar scores are between 7 and 10. Baby girl initially had an Apgar score of only 3, considered critically low. Doctors and nurses suctioned the meconium out of her little lungs. On the other hand, Fella had an Apgar score of 8 and came out screaming like an opera singer. Alira was retested after a couple more minutes and her Apgar score improved to 7, nearly matching her big brother. Baby girl was placed in the NICU. It turned out the complications wouldn't end with baby girl. I was pretty banged up myself. I lost a substantial amount of blood. My OBGYN explained to me at the time that about 1,100 cc's of blood is the average amount of blood loss during a C-section procedure such as that one. I lost 2,200 cc's. I was placed on level 1 narcotics to combat the pain. I didn't always remember which family members called to congratulate me on our new baby and which didn't. I remember coming to in my hospital room and my original OBGYN sitting in the corner waiting for me. He said that he physically wanted to see me in the flesh because he heard what had happened. He told me that I lost quite a bit of blood and that I needed to take it easy. He said that I would be under observation and to take it easy when I started to eat again. I would end up feeding my newborn in the NICU for much of our stay. I would eventually gain back an appetite as well, and I was grateful for that. Big brother, Fella, came to the hospital with his grandparents, and he very graciously tried to feed his baby sister a cracker. Thank God we stopped him. I didn't need any more surprises associated with this hospital stay. We were eventually discharged from the hospital. There is no way that an experience like that won't get you thinking about life. Both in the hospital and on the drive home, I started really entertaining the idea of taking a break from work for a while. I was 33 with a fancy-ish work title. Deciding to leave my career as I was rising up that attorney ladder was the equivalent to blasphemy for a first-generation American born to 2 Nigerian parents. So I first kept the idea to myself as I gained strength and started to feel like myself again. After all, I didn't really have to do anything until the end of maternity leave. While on leave, we learned that my husband got a full scholarship to obtain his MBA at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The scholarship would come with housing and dirt-cheap health insurance. The thought of a simpler, less stressful life was highly appealing to me at that time. The rat race in a big city like Chicago no longer felt appealing to me at that time. What did feel right was a smaller town where I could find work and be with my very small children. I eventually found ways to tell both my parents-in-law, and my boss. I know they all thought I had lost my mind, but it was something that I knew I needed to do, even if occasionally I would ask myself those very same questions. My last week on the job, when my boss was introducing me to new employees, he introduced me by saying, "This is Lola Dada Ali, currently my deputy counsel, soon to be off to parts unknown." What he said ended up being far more true than he could ever imagine. A good part of Alero's first year of life would be in the midst of parents grappling with the diagnosis of her older brother. Any parent going from 1 child to 2 will likely tell you that a serious adjustment period is required. With the added layer of dealing with the fresh diagnosis, guilt occasionally did set in. I wondered if I was giving her as much attention as she should be receiving. She didn't crawl for long, and it felt like she almost went straight to walk. By the time Fela started his intensive ABA therapy regimen, Alira was 11 months old. At 9 months, she said, "Mama." But in the 2 months that followed, not much was added to her vocabulary. I didn't really worry about her at first, though, since autism was so much more prevalent in boys than girls. Growing up, my mom used to tell me that, given the severity of my brother Kunle's special needs, she was grateful that he wasn't a girl. If he was, she would have to worry about so many more considerations from a life skills perspective, she said. I honestly hadn't thought of a scenario where I could have more than one child with autism. Alero used to look at Fela dead in the eye and smile around this time. Just when she was trying to engage, Fela was now retreating into his own world. It would be shortly after her big brother started his therapy that I would notice behaviors in Alero that made me take a second look. With the three-year-old already in speech therapy, occupational therapy, ABA therapy, and special education, our plate was already pretty full. But we somehow navigated life with a toddler and infant. What I did notice was that her vocabulary wasn't really coming into play the way her brothers had around that time. Besides mama, not much was added on to. I reached out to the state's early intervention team yet again, but this time for child number two. They started administering speech therapy services to her after they had done their own evaluation. I called the Wisconsin Early Autism Project and asked an important question when Alira was a little over a year old. "How soon can you evaluate and diagnose a child with autism?" I asked. I was redirected to a psychologist. She told us that the earliest we could test would be 18 months. So I scheduled an autism evaluation for Alero the day commemorating 18 months of her life on this earth. As we waited for that day to come, we were invited to a fellow university student's family get-together. We both had daughters around the same age, about 13, 14 months old or so. Being at the gathering was jarring because we were so busy running around with Fela, taking care of his needs, and now juggling that with what would be the start of Alero's services. I realized then that I hadn't really had many opportunities where Alero was with other little girls her age. Seeing another little girl Alero's age was a lot. Looking back, I was not mentally prepared for it. In comparison to Alero, she was pointing and smiling and starting to mimic words, while Alero sat in the corner perfectly content with being alone and not saying or doing much of anything. Where Fela was more of a regression, Alero's challenges were emerging from a different array of obstacles. Alero appeared more to mimic almost a failure to launch. Alero's behavior started to mimic my brother's own even more closely. It was like she was the daughter he never had.
Alero, we had not really heard her speak or hit those milestones. So there was this fear and acknowledgement or settlement right off the bat that this one was going to be different and this was going to be a tougher slug.
Since autism diagnosis in boys is so much more prevalent, I honestly didn't think it to be possible that she too could have autism until I started seeing what I was seeing. For a while after, seeing little girls around Alero's age who had no challenges playing with others or showing love to their family members would expose a wound I did not know I had. As the days leading up to the diagnostic evaluation for autism grew closer, I started thinking about things my mother used to say about Kunle's autism. Those old memories, mixed with the knowledge of how hard my pregnancy was, not hearing a heartbeat in the last trimester, her coming into this world not breathing, me losing all that blood, it was a lot. Oh yeah, She definitely has autism, without a doubt. Those were the words of our daughter's psychologist at the end of her evaluation. Definitely a different style from Dr. Payton's, our son's psychologist, who delivered the news the year before. Our family had been dealt a second major challenge ahead of us. Okay, I managed to express. So what does that mean? Tosa asked. I could tell that this response to Alero's diagnosis was already going to be different. The moment Alero blessed us with her presence into this world, Tosan was hooked. That was his baby girl. The psychologist recommended that our 18-month-old do 40 hours of ABA therapy immediately. I was trying to work out how that would even look, given the fact that we had another child doing another form of intensive therapy at the same time. As I was trying to discuss this with the psychologist, Tosa very uncharacteristically cut me off and said that we should revisit the number of hours of therapy later. He clearly had a lot to process, and so did I. This was a lot for everyone. I was trying to logically remember that, but I was also angry at him for cutting me off in front of the therapist the way that he did. I knew having another diagnosis so close to the first one felt like another blow, simply due to the giant uncertainty of it all. As we walked back to the car, I couldn't shut my brain off. Less than a year earlier, we received our son's diagnosis. We were now grappling with our daughters. Would this too be just for a season, like Dr. P mentioned at Fellas session? Or would this be a significant lifelong challenge in the form of my brother? Only time would tell, and only God knew the answer. I got into the car, and of course, you guessed it, I cried. Tosan walked behind me, with him and baby girl in hand, as they approached the car. He put her in her car seat. The united front we enjoyed as husband and wife upon Fela's diagnosis was nearly non-existent when Alero's diagnosis rolled around. Maybe it was the stress of intensive therapy over the previous several months raising an infant, or the financial strain that now came along with both of us being out of the workforce longer than initially anticipated, or the poor delivery of diagnosis number two, or maybe some combination of all three. Instead of consoling one another at such a difficult time in our family and in our marriage, we ended up screaming at one another all the way home. I wanted to throw everything we possibly could at Alero right away because time was of the essence. Tosan needed time to process all that was happening. He thought that getting her out of the house in a daycare for a little while would be helpful before we went full on ABA therapy. We both got home and gave each other the silent treatment. Tosan, having a huge, healthy outlet called school, went to the library. I was in the apartment left with two kids. And Fela had therapy in the afternoon. I started to feel myself unravel. Getting two life-changing diagnoses less than a year apart was not in my life plan. I called an aunt, not actually related to me by blood, but a very close friend of my family for decades, since I was a little girl. I confided in her that I was worried for my mental health. My time in Wisconsin was supposed to be a time where I pursued creative outlets, like writing. It was supposed to be a time where I was supposed to figure out what I was really meant to be doing on this earth. She listened, and listened, and listened some more. Then she started. "Listen to me, Lala. I wish I could be there with you right now, but I can't be. I am always a phone call away. And you know I'm here to listen. But you have got to get the counseling you need to get through this. You have a very big challenge ahead of you. You have all the tools you need to not only survive, but to thrive." I knew she was right. She gave sound advice, and I knew that I needed counseling. So I got that ball rolling by setting up an appointment with a counselor through the university system. Life would eventually morph into a dizzying array of approximately 70 hours of various therapies, now involving two children, constituting driving these babies to some form of therapy or being in home for other forms of therapy that can be administered in the home, or waiting for the school bus to take Fela to and from special education from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., depending on the day, Monday through Saturday, for nearly 2 years. Alero enjoyed a brief stint in daycare, just so that both she and I could have a break from therapy. But watching that lack of interaction she had with the other children really brought home the point that time was better spent in therapy. So that's what we did. I didn't have any family in Wisconsin. The original plan was for me to be out of the workforce 6 months max. It would turn out to be nearly 4 years instead. Realizing that someone needed to take care of this healthcare apparatus full time, I didn't work. Time was of the essence. Tosan was handling all this by channeling his energy into school, studying and student groups close to his heart, like diversity and business. I started to slowly resent him for having these positive outlets. I felt more and more alone. I would think back not too long ago to those early days in Wisconsin when baby Alero was trying to engage with her brother through eye contact. He was busy retreating into himself instead. Now the roles were almost completely reversed. Big brother was trying to engage with the outside world again and trying to engage with his little sister. But she now no longer had interest in socially interacting with him or really with any of us, except through necessities like food and drink. Like her uncle before her, baby girl would use nonverbal communication to tell us she was hungry. But in her early days, she didn't smile as much as her brother or her uncle. She walked through life with quiet, serious confidence where social interaction just simply wasn't a priority. Milestone after developmental milestone was missed. She wouldn't respond to most questions or consistently reciprocate smiles or gestures. She too would look off into the distance into such a deep place that at times it was difficult to get her attention. She wouldn't play with other kids. She wouldn't really play with toys. Instead, she would walk around with action figures, but not appear to really know how to use them for any forms of imaginative play. When she would be out near the playground in the grass sitting down, she would sometimes take a handful of nearby dirt and put it in her mouth and just chew. She would do the same with sand and other non-edible items. Less than 8 weeks post-diagnosis, we once again set up an autism treatment infrastructure around her like we did with her older brother, complete with her own developmental pediatrician, ABA therapy team in speech, occupational and physical therapy teams. Given the severity of her challenges, we decided not to enroll her in special education right away, but instead to focus on as much therapy as we could. Friends from what I called at the time my past life, friends from law school, friends from my legal career back in Chicago, would occasionally call to catch up, and I would tell them about the double diagnosis. One friend listened intently as I told her my story up to that point. Instead of telling me varying forms of I'm sorry, like other friends had, I instead received the following response. Well, I guess you know what your calling is. At the very least, you know what at least part of it entails. That was a game changer for me. I had never looked at it like that before. Our baby girl Alero was the final piece in the overall puzzle. Later medical examinations would diagnose baby girl with both autism and intellectual disability.
It was less of a shock, but it hurt more because at the same time, the rush of emotions, you know, this is daddy's baby girl, you know, baby girl has had me wrapped around her finger for a while. Kunle being our template, our, you know, our reference point. Alero's autism always seemed more similar to Kunle's. So when the diagnosis about intellectual disability and, you know, the speech impairment came about, I was probably better prepared for that than I was the first autism diagnosis. And I wasn't surprised. But it just reinforced what was already in my mind as to the challenges of, you know, the acknowledgement that we were going to have to go through a very similar walk that your parents took with different tools, with more updated tools, but a very similar walk, you know, and all that comes with that, the pressures on the marriage, you know, having seen how it affected Mama and Papa Dada's marriage and just their later years in life, and trying to fast forward and almost plan and see into the future, the next 50 years at the same time. I'm trying to understand what it would take as a father to protect, provide, and parent my baby girl. Everything came to a head. It was a bit of a blur, but it at least gave us some, I don't know if certainty is the word, it gave us something to go attack with whatever tools and therapies that we are in our toolkit.
Dr. Payton and I recently discussed society's view of autism.
One of the things that I love and also fear that's happening right now is the picture of autism, the face of autism is changing. And I love some of the ways that it's changing. But it's changing, frankly, to folks more like Phila. And that's who is portrayed now. And that's who folks want to talk about now. And I'm worried that folks like Alero may be left behind a bit as that is happening. And we need to go to that more middle, reasonable place and recognize that everybody has needs and they are different needs.
There's still a long way to go. In the meantime, we as a family will continue to do our best to make sure that both our kids become the best versions of themselves by showering them with whatever resources we have available for their learning and development.
Will Alero ever get to the stage phases in terms of cognitive ability that her brother is showing? I don't know. But she, over the last 2-3 years, I have seen an unfolding almost like a beautiful flower that has taken its sweet time to bloom. And she reveals a petal after another, a little bit at a time. And each time she does it, there is this, almost like she's sending a signal, and maybe this is just me in my head, sending a signal to me, like, keep fighting. I still got a lot more to offer in this world. And anytime we get to a point where it's just like, you know, this is a lot, she unfolds one more petal, and you're like, just gives you a little bit more oomph to your step to, you know, to keep fighting. Not like we'll ever give up, but I look forward to that, celebrating the little victories and the unwrapping of her personality, of her laugh, of her spirit. And I can't wait to see what the 18-year-old, 21-year-old woman look like.
Please welcome our daughter, Alero. She will be communicating both verbally and through her iPad, her communication device.
Say hi, Alero.
Hi.
How are you? What's your name? How old are you?
I'm 7 years old.
Bye.
Bye.
Alero is resilience personified. She continues to add to her vocabulary and is showing improvement in both her expressive and receptive communication. Being a daddy's girl, Alero prefers for her dad to put her to bed. They have their own little routine, including a little prayer right before she goes to bed.
Alero, let's say our prayer. You ready? Thank.
Okay.
Four.
Me.
Nine.
Watching Alero improve in her interactions with her brother is a welcomed improvement. Given their different ability levels, playtime can sometimes not be a very long exercise, but Big Brother is learning to meet her at her level and protect her whenever he can.
Alero is my little sister. She's really nice and happy. She has sleep problems, but whatever. So she has her problems, but she's the best little sister that I could ever have.
If it takes a village to raise a child, it may take two to raise a child with special needs. It was time to build a community that valued inclusion so that we wouldn't function in isolation. In episode 5, we discuss how we started to put together the village essential to the rebuilding of our family as we know it today. Thank you for listening. If you are enjoying what you hear, please tell at least 2 other people and leave a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe. We are available nearly anywhere you can download podcasts. See you in 2 weeks.